Hi everybody, this is your host Paul. Today we're going to be talking with Mr. Michael Witwer, the author of Empire of Imagination, Gary Gygax, and The Birth of Dungeons & Dragons, published by Bloomsbury in 2015. Hi Michael, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul. Thrilled to be here.
So can you maybe just start, as is the tradition on the network, with telling us a little bit about yourself and your background, as well as your background with Dungeons & Dragons?
Sure. There's quite a bit in that, but I think I'll start at the very beginning. It's often the best place to start, I suppose. Firstly, with Dungeons & Dragons, I've been playing D&D since I was probably 5 or 6 years old. I'll never forget, actually, my introduction to the game, because I remember my brother wanted these D&D books that you know, he'd been playing the game with a neighborhood kid. And this same kid was selling his books. And so I remember going with him and my father over to this kid's house and my father haggling with this teenage kid, basically, to buy his late 70s, 1980s, D&D books, which was like a 1 or 2 foot high stack of these great old books. So Sam took it home. My brother Sam took it home and we, started playing. He was probably, 9 or 10, and I was, again, probably 5, 6, 7, somewhere in that range. So I've been playing D&D ever since. It's been pretty much a lifelong hobby and passion. In the meantime, of course, I grew up and did all the things that usual people do. I went to high school and, ended up going to College of Northwestern University, where I was actually, majoring in music and musical theater. So my aspiration was actually to be something more in the performing arts, world, which I think is, again, I would on many levels relate that to my background in Dungeons and Dragons. Again, I grew up more out of that and ended up getting into a career of product marketing and proposal writing, which is what I do to this day. I'm a director of proposal and marketing for a national healthcare services company. So that's my trade, you might say. But in the process of all of that, I was getting my master's at the University of Chicago, and I had an opportunity to write basically a master's thesis or a master's special project of my choosing. And I ended up picking something that was very near and dear to me, which, of course, was Dungeons and Dragons, specifically a biographical project on Gary Gygax, who, of course, I had been aware of for my whole life. You know, this was the gentleman that was on the front of all these books that I grew up with. But I never had given a lot of thought to the man behind the name, you might say. And so this particular project I did a few years ago gave me the opportunity to go ahead and explore his background and the history of this great game that I, grew up with. That ended up being an extensive enough project that I adapted it into book length and actually shopped and got myself an agent and then ended up selling the book to Bloomsbury, as you suggested, for a publication of 2015. So that's a lot, but I tried to condense it as best I could anyway.
Great. And what was your general methodology, Michael, in approaching this research project? Your book is really exhaustive. It's impressive in terms of the number of sources you bring to bear. And you rely on interviews and quite a few other primary sources.
Good question. So the methodology at first was certainly kind of, trying to figure it out as you go. So considering that it started as a traditional research project at the University of Chicago, that was certainly the place I started, right? The concept of really mining as many book and archival sources as you could. And then realizing that because I live in Chicago, so I live relatively close to where a lot of this went down there in Lake Geneva, which is about, 70 miles away, 70 miles north, realizing that I might actually get access to a lot of the individuals that were there in the form of interviews. And that's exactly really how it went down is I really kind of started looking under some rocks and realizing that the people that while people like Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson have since passed away, a lot of the people that were working very closely with them and knew them really better than anybody else were alive and well and nearby. And not only that, but actually uniquely accessible, which I think made it a really interesting process. So, I mean, I was pretty amazed when I could reach out to people like Steve Chenault, one of his late associates from Trollord Games, or reach out to Tim Kask, the original editor of Dragon Magazine. Or Frank Mentzer or any number of the Gygax family who ended up kind of introducing me to I would do an interview, say, with Luke, and he would introduce me to Ernie, so on and so forth. And so it was really this kind of, I guess it's a critical path that I could have never planned, because you don't really know who you're going to get a hold of and who they're going to introduce you to or where you're going to go from there. So again, it's hard to say that it's a particularly strategic methodology. It's kind of like you dive in and you start uncovering things under rocks and you keep going and going and going, until you start really getting some incredible information. Then you start connecting the dots on things and realizing you've got a fairly cohesive and interesting narrative. So that's pretty much how it went. Again, starting with the impetus of doing it as part of this research project at the University of Chicago.
Well, why don't we get into the book then? Can you just take us a little bit through what Gary's childhood and adolescent years in Chicago and then subsequently in Lake Geneva, what were those like? Were there some insights that you took from those years that later led into his inspiration around fantasy role playing? I had no idea, for example, when you talked about his dislike for Tolkien, because so much of his work seems so Tolkien-esque. Yeah, can you just maybe talk us through some of those early years?
Absolutely. Well, so, you know, one thing that happens when you study a person in this depth is that you realize you start to think everything is important, right? And to a certain extent it is. When you're really deep in the research on somebody, your natural inclination is to make connections about, oh, they used to love to do this. That must be how they came up with that. Well, you know, and to a certain extent you can do that, but you have to always remember that unless they ever said it or unless there was something that really suggested that this is absolutely an inspiration for that, you don't really want to, you have to be careful about making those connections, I think. So, you know, the early life, again, I can think of a lot of things early in his life that clearly, if they didn't inspire later things, they certainly told you a lot about the person. And that was really what the thrust of my book was more about, was trying to show you and tell you about this wonderful, amazing person named Gary Gygax, who did these incredible things. So, you know, starting very early, yeah, he was born in Chicago. He was born in Chicago in 1938 and grew up here only as a young boy. You know, he had a much, much older half-brother and sister. His father was actually well into his 50s by the time Gary was born. So he was a somewhat elderly father and a much younger mother who had, again, been married once before. Again, Gary grew up in this kind of very traditional lifestyle in a little bit of an up-and-coming neighborhood. I might call it a rough neighborhood at the time, about a mile away from Wrigley Field, a little bit north of there. And what ended up happening was his father, who was a suit salesman at Rothschild & Company, which is a big department store downtown, decided to move the family when Gary was about, I think it was 7 years old. Based on this big brawl that Gary got into with a couple of neighborhood kids. Basically, he was in this kind of little neighborhood gang, which I don't know, that's probably overstating what it really was. It was a bunch of kids up to no good on his street. And they got into a big fight. And what ended up happening was, as a result of this, his parents both thought this is really not a good neighborhood. It's not a good place to be. And they wanted to find a more wholesome, safer environment to raise their young son, Gary. Again, the other two children were quite a bit older. So they did. They moved up to Lake Geneva, which is where Gary's mother, Posey, which is her nickname, Elmina Posey, was from. Her parents still lived there in this big green Victorian house on Dodge Street. So after Gary's brawl, the parents move up to this wonderful grand Victorian house on Dodge Street. They move in with with Gary's grandparents. And that's where Gary grows up, really. So that's really where you would say his childhood starts more than anything else. Now, that's not to ignore some of the important things that happened in Chicago really early on. You know, Gary talks, or Gary used to talk, I should say, very with a lot of sentiment around going to the Field Museum, for example, and looking at all these wonderful cases of stuffed animals and birds. And I remember always thinking to myself how in a weird sort of way, the taxidermy exhibit at the Field Museum, which is this labyrinthine maze of stuffed animals and monsters, you might say, that's like the original monster manual in a weird sort of way. So there's a lot of things like that. Of course, the Field Museum has this tremendous mummy exhibit, an Egyptian exhibit. And of course, many, many of Gary's later works were Egyptian themed. So again, it would be natural to make the connection that Gary found a lot of these early inspirations doing things like that. So again, growing up to cut to the chase with his Lake Geneva life. So of course, Lake Geneva is this really interesting place for many, many reasons. You know, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, for one thing, is a resort community for kind of wealthy regional executives from Milwaukee and Chicago. That is to say, it has these tremendous mansions that surround the lake. And it's this beautiful, very deep fishing river. It's lake. And it's probably the closest, really legitimate fishing and scenic destination you can get if you live in somewhere like Chicago, which of course is very flat and otherwise fairly industrial. So, Gary moves from, again, this urban environment to this place that he used to only visit his grandparents once in a while, which is Lake Geneva. And it's just this amazing town for him, right? It's a very small town during the off season. In the summer, the population swells to, 20, 30, 40,000 people. But year round, a town like Lake Geneva has got like 8,000, 5,000, 8,000 permanent residents. So it's basically a small fishing town for most of the year. And as a result, Gary, of course, loves to wander the town and pull pranks. He was a tremendous prankster, always up to something, very Rockwell-esque type of childhood, you might say. And one of the things he likes to do is he likes to wander around when he gets a little bit older. Anyway, he likes to wander around this abandoned insane asylum that's on the highest point in town. Because one thing that's unique about Lake Geneva is not only was it this kind of rustic fishing town, and not only was it this resort destination for Chicago executives, it was also, because it was peaceful and serene and beautiful, it was also considered really therapeutic for people with mental disorders. So as a result, there's like a bunch of sanitariums and institutions in and around the Lake Geneva area, including this one that was at really the most prominent spot in town. So one of the things Gary used to love to do was go and wander around these ruins. And it really was in ruins by the time Gary was a kid. But it's like something out of a movie. I mean, if you could see pictures of what was called the Oakwood Sanitarium, it's pretty incredible. This big old kind of a kind of a Romanesque style building with windows all knocked out. And it was kind of like a dungeon. And again, Gary used to suggest that a lot of his dungeon ideas, I should say, for his modules anyway, came from wandering the catacombs and the lower laundry tunnels of this particular place. So Lake Geneva was this kind of wonderful and great adventure for this very imaginative and kind of troublemaking kid growing up, Gary Gygax. And so, again, a lot of the things that he does really set his mind into motion when it comes to imagination. And I will point out at least one other thing that I think is particularly important to his growing up is outside of going to the movie theater and watching, weekly serials that have all kinds of different traps and adventure scenes going on. He claims that he had two paranormal experiences in his grandparents' house that were very formative to him. One was kind of just bump in the night upstairs in the attic situation. The other was this tremendous experience where he talks about it. He described it very vividly in a few different accounts where he talked about reading The Fall of the House of Usher in the sitting room, in the parlor, I should say. And there was a maid's room off of the parlor. No maid at that point, but there was a maid's room off the parlor. And there was a door that was about, a foot open. He was sitting there home alone with his cat cue ball in his lap. And he claims that as he was at a particularly dramatic part in the book, on this rainy day, I think it was in November, he looks up and he sees the maid's room door open another foot and a half or 2 feet. And that disembodied footsteps walk up to his chair and stop. And he just freaks out and he gets up out of his chair, runs upstairs. And instead of running out of the house, as you would expect most people would do, he ends up getting his lemonwood bow and his machete and going back downstairs and monitoring the door for the rest of the afternoon until his mother came home. And I always thought that was such a great story, if for no other reason to show you the kind of guy Gary was. Instead of running from danger, he's the guy that was going to arm himself and come back to the scene of the crime. So, again, I think that's a pretty good illustration of the kind of person and the kind of childhood Gary had.
Yeah, I like the anecdote with the lemonwood bow. That stuck with me when I read the book. Segueing into Gary's early married years in Lake Geneva, he married a girl who he had, I understand, grown up playing with as a child. And you describe this situation of dueling passions where he's married, but things are somewhat tempestuous because of the amount of time and obsession that Gary was putting into his wargaming. Can you describe that period in Gary's life?
Absolutely. So, a couple of things happen there. So, you know, obviously Gary grows up, he's kind of this small town bad boy, very brilliant guy, but, you know, doesn't finish high school, right? He drops out of high school his junior year, which I think is an amazing part of this story. Never gets a driver's license. Again, other stories that contribute to this amazing life this guy had and all that he accomplished, in the face of some of these things that he didn't do. So doesn't finish high school, let alone college, ends up getting a job, I think it was in the mailroom at first at an insurance company downtown Chicago. In those days, you could train from Lake Geneva to Wisconsin to Chicago and back. That train line no longer runs that whole route, but you could do it back then. It was about an hour and a half each way. And he reconnects with this girl of his childhood, Mary Jo Powell, who he used to play with as a very young boy. And then she moved away for a number of years. And when she came back, at around adolescent time, they weren't really connected anymore. And then she was kind of a good girl and she followed the rules and did her homework and all that stuff in high school. Whereas Gary, of course, was a bad boy, didn't do his homework, was doing all the things you weren't supposed to do. So they reconnected right after Gary actually did a very short stint in the Marines, where he actually got out of there pretty quickly as a result of mostly health reasons. But what ends up happening, is that he marries, Mary, and they moved to Chicago pretty quick, for Gary to be able to work these insurance job. And he actually ends up getting Mary a job there soon as well. Gary gets into insurance underwriting during this period. That becomes his career, you might say. And meanwhile, they start having kids. I think it was only about a year after they actually got married, they had their first child, Ernest Gary Gygax Jr., Ernie, as many people would know him today. What ends up happening is that Gary figures out pretty quickly once he gets into wargaming, which he does at about the same time as when he gets married, is that he becomes a slave to his hobbies and his passions. You know, Gary is always into something, and when he gets into something, he just jumps both feet into it. And we see that time and time again, whether it's actually oil painting on the side or wargaming or everything in between, he gets really, really obsessed with things, and he pursues them with all of his passion and all of his gusto. What happens pretty quickly, of course, is this becomes a wedge between he and his first wife, Mary. If for no other reason than, you know, Gary's working this job again for a good period of time, he's doing very long commutes. The young couple ends up moving back to Lake Geneva not too long. And then again, Gary's back on this commute trail of an hour and a half both ways each day. And then he'll go run off and, you know, play war games or something like that. And meanwhile, they're having kids every 2 years. So you can imagine by the late 60s or even 1970, as the child total gets nearer to five, finally gets to five. You can imagine that it becomes a not a very popular thing that Gary gets more and more involved in these wargaming groups and miniatures wargaming groups as time goes by. And again, these are not passive pastimes. They're the kind of things that you go away for a Saturday and you might spend 12 hours doing and come back in the middle of the night. You might do an all-nighter doing this stuff. And again, that's not super compatible with trying to raise a family, keep a job, and all the stuff that's involved in you know, kind of being able to meet all your commitments.
It's interesting how, I think you might have said it was later on in his life, he basically said, look, keep your wargaming and gaming to once a week if your wife's not into it.
Yeah, that was a pretty amazing quote that he made very late in his life. I want to say it was between 2005 and 2007. It was a message board quote. And again, an amazing turnaround, frankly, for a person that had really spent a huge portion of his young and early married years doing just that, doing nothing but
sure.
And stuff. And spending time with the kids. He really loved spending time with his kids, but it certainly leaves little time for the wife, certainly, if he's doing that much at work, that much with wargaming, and then the kids.
Yeah, and then he meets Dave Arneson. He gets Arneson's rules. There's also the lesser known sort of other Daves from the Twin City areas. There's Dave McGarry's board game, dungeon, all caps with an exclamation mark. And all of this gets fused into what will eventually become the first edition of Dungeons & Dragons. Can you talk us through these, you know, early encounters with Arneson and what happened there? Because it later becomes quite a controversy.
Absolutely. So yeah, I'll do my best to kind of hit the high points because it's a pretty complex story, as you can imagine. So around 1966 or so is when Gary really gets deep into wargaming circles. Now, so wargaming and miniatures, you know, tabletop wargaming is a pretty esoteric diversion at this point. There are really not that many people doing it. But those that are try to stay in touch via correspondence, specifically between letters and newsletters. They would put together these little newsletters that become these kind of little fanzines that would circulate to these national wargaming groups. But you're talking about like 20, 30 people nationwide. You know, you were lucky if we were in any proximity at all to someone you could play these games with. So Gary gets really into these hobbies in the mid 60s. And by, you know, 1967, you know, one of these wargaming groups that he's associated with decides that, wow, we should kind of hold a little convention. You know, we should try to get everyone together and see how it all goes. Well, they try that in Pennsylvania. And Gary, again, is kind of an officer of one of these wargaming groups. But again, think like a little fan club is all it really is. And it doesn't go very well, this Pennsylvania kind of meeting convention, if you will. Well, Gary does something kind of similar to at his house that year with about 20 gamers that he kind of brings in from the region, people from Illinois and Wisconsin and Minnesota. Basically, it was informal, but he had brought a bunch of people to his house, and he really loved this concept of bringing all these people to his little house on Center Street in Lake Geneva and having them sleep on the floor and doing this. So he continues to kind of correspond with people nationwide through these newsletters and through letters, he gets the idea that he thinks he might be able to run a better convention that was tried the year before, 1968. And so in 68, he goes ahead and tries to put up something called the Lake Geneva War Games Convention, Gen Con for short. And of course, it's the same Gen Con that you would know and love now that fetches, what, 60,000, 70,000 people a year in Indianapolis. That all started as this little, you know, kind of fan club wargaming convention in Lake Geneva. So Gary arranges it. He arranges the whole thing. There was a this little horticultural hall about a block away from his house, and he puts up the whole event there, and he gets about 100 people to come from across the country, and again, mostly the Midwest, but, you know, some people from the East Coast. It's a great success. You know, he's able to kind of mobilize this group of early wargamers, and that's a huge accomplishment if you consider the climate of wargaming at the time, which is, it's a completely disparate community of people that range from, say, roughly 10 years old to however old, you know, you might be. You could be 50 or 60, 70. But this is group, it's just not well organized group. And there's certainly no one that's bringing them all together in a place. But Gary does it in 1968 at Gen Con 1. And that really gets the ball rolling in a lot of ways. Again, it gets Gary in the face of people that are innovating, that are doing basically rules modification and different things. And meanwhile, Gary's doing the same thing in the course of writing for these fanzines. You know, he's trying to contribute, all basic, by the way, free of charge. He's doing this all for passion in his free time, whatever that looks like to Gary, who has none. And so what happens by 1969 is, again, the wargaming community starts getting a little bit more solidified, again, largely through Gary's efforts. And at Gen Con 2, he meets this young college student named Dave Arneson, who is a college student at in St. Paul, Minneapolis area. And he comes down to basically take part in this gaming convention that is a little bit bigger, I think, that second year, 1969. And they get to talking and realizing they have a lot of similar interests. And one thing that's on both of their minds ends up being, well, they're both very interested in Napoleonic war games, that is to say, war games of the Napoleonic era. And so that's where they first kind of have a bond over, like, what they could do with war games in that particular genre. And this starts this relationship where they start corresponding very regularly, and they start collaborating on various types of rules modifications. So meanwhile, Gary, a few things are happening in Gary's life that are particularly interesting, I think at least relevant to the story. One of which is that by 1970, he loses his job as an insurance underwriter at the Fireman's Fund of Chicago. That's important for a couple reasons. One is that he has his fifth kid within weeks of losing this job. So his family all of a sudden is on the ropes financially. They were already living on a very tight shoestring budget, but they become very much on the ropes. But it has kind of an unforeseen consequence, which is that while Gary is now broken and literally living on food stamps with his family trying to kind of make it all work, it frees him up to have a lot of time to do wargame and miniatures design, game design, which, of course, is Gary's passion. It's actually one of the reasons that he lost his job at the Fireman's Fund of Chicago. It was kind of suggested that he was focusing a little bit more on his hobbies than his work. So Gary all of a sudden has a lot of time on his hands, and he's been collaborating with this small mail order gaming company in Indiana called Gaiden Games, a fellow named Don Lowry that owns it. And Lowry asks Gary to go ahead and start designing games for him under this mail order label. So he does. Gary designs a couple of board games, but most importantly, he designs this little miniatures rule set called Chainmail, with a collaborator named Jeff Perrin. So Jeff Perrin is in Gary's local gaming group. They have this local game group called the Lake Geneva Tactical Studies Association. And these two gentlemen decide to formalize some little miniatures rules. And again, think of like a big sand table is what they play on. And they've got these little elastalin plastic miniature figures that they recreate these battles with, right? And they have various mechanics that dictate how these games go. Well, they put together this really formalized set of rules to run a miniatures game. But what's really important about Chainmail that comes out in 1971 through Gaiden Games is that at the end of Chainmail, the last section of Chainmail is something that Gary calls the fantasy supplement, which is really interesting for a lot of reasons. The fantasy supplement basically suggests that let me back up. For Chainmail, if it's not obvious from the title, I'm sure it actually isn't, because a lot of this stuff's really not very obvious at all or intuitive. But so Chainmail is important because it's a medieval miniatures game. At the time, very few people were thinking about medieval miniatures. It was actually mostly historical war miniatures from, say, World War II or the Napoleonic era. Very few people went back to the medieval era to use for miniatures mechanics. It just wasn't done for whatever reason. So here Gary puts out this medieval version of a miniatures game. And it's got this thing called the fantasy supplement at the end. And the natural connection is that most fantasy basically is set in what we would describe as kind of a faux medieval era, right? Think Lord of the Rings. It's kind of this medieval style world with magic and so on and so forth, monsters. So Gary gets this idea to put in the fantasy supplement. And the fantasy supplement pretty much says, hey, if you want to take these medieval miniature rules and apply them to a fantasy game, say recreate the battles of Tolkien, you can go ahead and do that. And he actually gives mechanics about how that would work with wizards and heroes, these, basically knights. Wizards have spells and different, there are monsters. There are all these different things that wouldn't otherwise exist, let's say, in a traditional medieval miniatures game. And again, so he outlines these things, and it's not a particularly long supplement, but there it is. And so people start buying this game. And again, it's not making anybody rich, whether it be Gaiden Games or Gary himself, but it is selling a lot of copies for a little pamphlet booklet. I want to say it's about a 60-page little pamphlet size booklet. And so again, this thing is selling, hundreds of copies, which is a big deal in a world where there are basically no participants. And the fantasy thing is really getting a lot of people's attention. Namely, his recent acquaintance and now is on and off again collaborator, Dave Arneson. And Arneson takes these fantasy rules that he saw in Chainmail, and he ends up applying them to this other concept that he's been working on in the Twin Cities. So that you mentioned the two other Daves, right? So you've got these three people, right? You've got Dave Wesley, Dave McGarry, and Dave Arneson, who are all interested in all kinds of things, whether it be Napoleonics or medieval games, all these things. And they've all contributed these different pieces to what becomes this game that Dave Arneson starts running on a regular basis with this group called Blackmoor. One thing that Blackmoor does is it takes Gary's Chainmail Fantasy Supplement and it really applies that as the combat mechanics of this game called Blackmoor. But what makes Blackmoor unique is that it's a game where you don't play a battalion or a whole army of characters as you would, say, in a miniatures war game. You play a single character in Blackmoor. And your character actually has quantifiable statistics and a name, and you actually declare your actions for your character, and you go to these underground dungeon adventures. And you it has this kind of first-person role assumption that nothing else had really done, at least in any formalized way, at this point. And so, again, you could say as a matter of lineage or chain of title even, this little chainmail miniatures war game that Gary designed with this fantasy element that got people thinking a lot more about fantasy games kind of inspired Dave Arneson to apply all these, put all these pieces together and roll it out for this group of Twin Cities gamers. So when Gary gets wind of this Blackmoor game and actually gets to witness Arneson run a campaign of it when he comes to Lake Geneva, he sees that it is something absolutely special and really incomparable. Gary gets extremely excited about it. So he asks Arneson to provide him some whatever rules he might have written out, to which Arneson provides basically his notes on the game, you know, which is as Gary used to describe it, you know, 18 pages of scribbles and notes. No one's ever seen those notes, so no one can really say exactly what was in them. But it is fairly established that it was some preliminary notes that Dave was keeping for his own campaign. He never really thought about publishing this game at the time yet. So Gary takes this and decides he wants to collaborate with Dave Arneson and write a new game that uses this general concept and these pieces to put together something entirely new. And that's exactly what they do between 1973 and 1974. Or I should say, during the course of 1973, D&D comes out in 74. They collaborate via mostly correspondence, and Gary takes these notes and really develops it into a very, very codified, very, very detailed game that comes in these three little 50-page booklets, all part of a big leather wood grain box set that becomes the original Dungeons & Dragons box set released in 1974. So that's kind of how it all came about is it was many, many pieces that contributed to it and kind of the right people talking at the right time. And by early 1974, D&D is upon the wargaming market.
Really incredible, multifaceted history. And your recall for it is really impressive. Turning more to Gygax's personal life, did you get a feeling when you were doing your research about what the Gygax household was like? For example, I didn't realize that they were Jehovah's Witnesses, and then this sort of started to create some tension with their son Ernie when he started to move away from that faith in his early life. What was their household like, do you think?
The Gygax household was certainly described as a very loving household and a fairly chaotic household, really, for a lot of reasons. I mean, again, if you think through the 60s, I think Ernie is born in Ernie's born in 1959. Elise is born in 1961. So, I mean, they're having kids like roughly every 2 years. And again, by 1970, they've got five kids in this little tiny house in Lake Geneva, which is a rented house, by the way. They don't own it. And they're living on a shoestring the whole time. And, you know, in the course of all of this, you know, Gary is commuting all of this time. He's obsessed with these hobbies. He's spending an inordinate amount of time away from home doing these hobbies. And of course, it's really becoming a barrier between he and his wife, Mary. And in the course of all of this, Mary ends up getting fairly associated with the Jehovah's Witnesses, the local congregation, and ends up bringing in Gary, who actually gets fairly interested in it himself. And he does take on the ideology. He does have some involvement in the church. I wouldn't call it heavy duty involvement, but certainly some. And that's just kind of one of the many backdrops that's happening in this family life as they move forward. And really, they have this very tumultuous, very chaotic family life where money is very scarce. Time is very scarce. And all the while, you've got this kind of creative genius who's fairly eccentric, right? Who's kind of leading the family into the unknown, right? And that's really, I think, what causes actually a lot of closeness of the individual brothers and sisters, but certainly became a major wedge between Gary and Mary Jo. I mean, does that answer your question largely?
I think, yeah. And were there any surprises for you as your research on Gary's life unfolded, things that really you were perhaps taken aback by or anything like that?
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, it was surprise after surprise for me, especially walking in to the topic without a ton of background knowledge on Gary. Granted, I played the game my whole life, and I knew what everybody knows about the general history of D&D or even Gary. But of course, you know, Gary had been attached to all kinds of unfair rumors and nonsense, you know, during the Satanic Panic era, right? That area of the 80s where people got very afraid of this game. For many reasons that we can talk about separately. I just didn't have a lot of depth or background knowledge about Gary, other than the fact that he was this kind of shadowy figure that had created this amazing game that lived, you know, 70 miles up the road in Lake Geneva all these years. And so for me, it was just surprise after surprise. It, you know, starting really early, if you consider the fact that, you know, he didn't have a driver's license, and he accomplished all that he did. He didn't finish high school, let alone college. You know, that to me is staggering if you consider how intellectual Dungeons & Dragons is, how literary the game is. And here's Gary, who was this fanatical reader of pulp fiction, of sci-fi, fantasy, you name it, wasn't particularly interested in school books, but did love history. You know, a guy that put all this stuff together without finishing a high school education. The thing that I think was most surprising to me, though, the thing that really kind of blew me away was the adversity, the circumstances around the creation of the game when it came out in 74. I had no concept, and I don't think most people do really had any concept of the level of adversity that Gary was facing when all that was going down. So by 1973, while he's working on this game, or early 74, Gary is basically unemployed. He's bought some cobbler equipment, and he's working as a part-time cobbler basically out of his basement. They've got no money. He's been unemployed now for what, you know, 3 years. And he's got five kids he's trying to support and feed. His back is really against the wall. And again, this is a guy that does not have a college degree, let alone a high school diploma. He doesn't have a driver's license. This is a person that has no resources. But what he does have is this unbelievable passion and this incredible creativity. And so he just rolls up his sleeves and he creates this game with what expectation? Who knows? But then for not only to write the game with Dave Arneson and put the whole thing together, but then to find a way to get it published, you know, this original 1,000 box, brown box copies that they put together, which cost a few $1,000s. And he has to take on partners in order to do this. One of his best friends, Don Kay, who ends up taking a life insurance, a loan on a life insurance policy he has to enable to contribute his part. Gary doesn't have any money to contribute. And that's when they take in this third partner, Brian Bloom, who does have some money to his name. And he's the one that makes it possible for this triple partnership now to go ahead and produce this game. But the actual circumstances around what's going with Gary at the time, he's got nothing going for him. It was literally his last hope to get this thing done. And sure enough, it becomes, you know, a marvel.
Amazing story. And in a way, you know, we may have his dismissal from the insurance company to thank for the creation of Dungeons and Dragons, I suppose, since it seemed like it gave him the time and the real impetus to do 100% his passion.
I agree with you. I like so many things. I think if things had gone differently, who knows when or how the game would have come out, if ever. I do believe that the circumstances probably never would have aligned had Gary not been dismissed, again, because it directly led to him being able to publish Chainmail through Gaiden Games. And Chainmail, again, gave Arneson the pieces he needed to put together his, you know, this Blackmoor campaign. So, yeah, I mean, again, if you look at the chicken egg part of it, it's definitely Back to the Future, right? If the McFlys don't meet, then Marty's never born, I guess.
Absolutely. Fast forwarding to past sort of his initial success at TSR and to the point in his life, which I wasn't aware of, where he actually moved out to California. He got a little sidelined in terms of the main aspect of TSR's business and basically got sent out there with the idea that there would be this Dungeons & Dragons entertainment wing. And I didn't realize the kind of lifestyle that he had led out in California, and you describe him as being a somewhat heavy recreational drug and alcohol user while he was out there, which is certainly not what I pictured when I had this image of Gary Gygax in my mind. What was that time for Gary like in California?
Well, I don't know if I described it quite as heavy. I mean, if for no other reason, I don't think I could describe it that way because it's never quite confirmed. I think there was a lot of rumors, you might say.
Oh, okay.
That Gary was doing heavy drug and alcohol. I mean, I can confirm that there was certainly some. But I can't go much beyond that. But what I can say certainly is that it was a wild lifestyle. I mean, it was certainly a wild, up all night, party hard and live very big lifestyle. So that I think is irrefutable. I mean, he was living on a 6-8 acre estate in Beverly Hills on the top of a mountain in King Vidor's estate. King Vidor was this great Hollywood producer director of the 20s and 30s. And that was TSR's West Coast headquarters, and where Gary lived. It was both his living circumstances and the, what they call Dungeons and Dragons entertainment company's headquarters. And that was basically where Gary set up operation to not only live large, which he was. I mean, I think he was really enjoying his time out in Beverly Hills for about a year and a half there from 83 to say mid 84, late 84. This is also where, you know, he's got writers from CBS coming over and where they're having storyboard sessions and stuff like that for the Dungeons and Dragons animated series cartoon that comes out in 1983. So it's this really, really great lifestyle for him. And I think it's very safe to say that it was a very wild time for him. And it was a rebound time for him. I think what's notable about it is that this is a guy by 83 who's been largely disenfranchised from the management of the company. He is still the face and the figurehead, but he doesn't own the majority shares. First of all, that's owned by his partners, the Blum Brothers, and he's lost a lot of his creative control in a lot of ways. And so, by 83, you pair that with the fact that his marriage has fallen apart, which again was bound to happen over all the years where they were kind of shift passing in the night. So his marriage has fallen apart. His mother dies just a couple of years before that, who was a really major stabilizing force for him. Gary was unstable, certainly by that time. I think he had had a lot of success. He had had a lot of money that had come to him as a result of designing this game that had really taken off. But he was in a really strange place in his life. And I think when it comes to his psychology,
a lot of the dissolution of Gary's involvement with TSR seems to stem from the time where they brought in Lorraine Williams as initially sort of a management consultant. They thought they needed someone with business savvy, and then she actually becomes a shareholder and eventually, I guess, the majority shareholder at TSR. So what, I realize you could speak for a long time about this, but just in short, what happened there that caused this conflict and Gary's eventual break with the company that he loved so much and that he created?
That's a great question. And I'll try to be as brief as I can, because as you know, it's an infinitely complex story when you look at all the different pieces that go into it. But I mentioned this a little bit earlier that Gary was forced to take on partners to produce the original game, right? That was a critical path item that had to happen. And one of them was the one of the Blum brothers, Brian Blum. And so that was important. And it worked out well for a long time. They actually got along really well for a long time. Well, as I mentioned, by 83, and really by the early 80s, around 80 is where people start not getting along quite as well. There are scuffles. And all the while, Gary never owns full ownership. I shouldn't say never, but again, that's a nuance that's not overly important to the story. For all intents and purposes, Gary never owns majority interest in TSR, the company that produces Dungeons and Dragons. Even though he's the founder, kind of the Steve Jobs part of this, he doesn't own majority interest. And so to that end, he's the driver of the company, he's the face of the company, but he's not truly the boss if you really take it to its logical conclusion. So this kind of comes out in a lot of different ways over time. But what ends up happening is he and the Blum brothers start becoming really they start having a fairly hostile relationship, which is one reason why, of course, Gary ends up going to Beverly Hills to get away from them and them to get away from him. So in the course of all of this, Gary actually meets this great young writer named Flint Dilley, who writes for Transformers and all these other eventually did write for Transformers and a lot of other, great cartoon shows, whatever. He was working on that stuff back then. And Flint Dilley is an interesting fellow for many reasons. He's a war gamer. He loves to come out to the Beverly Hills mansion and play games with Ernie and Gary and all these people. And Ernie and Flint actually start working on some kind of choose your own adventure books for TSR. And Flint Dilley comes from a family of John F. Dilley, who was the head of the National Newspaper Syndicate. And his family owned the IP rights to Buck Rogers. And so as a result, Dilley comes from some pretty significant money. And his sister, Lorraine, is someone who works in management, and she's, you know, an interested investor and all that stuff. So Gary gets to know Flint really well. And come 1984 or so, things really start going rough at TSR financially for a lot of reasons that we won't get into today. But there's a lot of things that they've really overexpanded as a company. They haven't managed their staff and they haven't managed their expenses well at all. And again, Gary's part of that. The Blooms are not doing very well at home in Lake Geneva. And then Gary again is spending a lot of money in Hollywood. And so what ends up happening is that Gary, first of all, finds a way to expel the Blooms from management, which is a little bit complicated because, again, there have been a board that had been taken on. So while the Blooms were still the majority shareholders, there were some mechanisms that Gary could play to get them kind of removed from day-to-day management. He manages to do this. And in the course of doing this, he needs to bring in fresh money to help fix the financial problems at TSR. And so one of the people he thinks of is this Lorraine Williams, the sister of one of his good friends, Flint Dilley, who can bring money with her and management skills. So Gary brings her on as like a general manager, a VP, and a hopeful investor. So that, you know, this is happening in basically what, early 1985 is where Gary kind of takes control of the administration of the company again and brings in Lorraine Williams. And he actually also at this point exercises a stock option where he does at least temporarily get majority interest, but it's the same stock option that the Blooms also have. They just choose not to exercise, right? So it's a little bit of kind of just kind of trading places in line for a little while. So anyway, the way this all resolves is that he brings in Ms. Williams, who really walks into a what is a pretty dysfunctional company. Certainly by her accounts, a place that's really not being run well, that is financially underwater. And so Gary really fights with all of his might to try to keep the company afloat, try to put out new products that return it to financial stability. But meanwhile, Gary is negotiating with the Bloom brothers for their shares. Now that they're kind of disenfranchised from the administration of the company, they want to unload their shares. And Gary is trying to get a deal. Well, what ends up happening is that after basically unsuccessful negotiations between Gary and the Bloom brothers, the Blooms end up going to Lorraine Williams, who at this point has become a little bit disillusioned with both TSR and Gary specifically. They really do not get along, it turns out. And she ends up buying the shares outright from the Bloom brothers. So she buys majority interest in TSR by the end of 1985 and takes over the company and subsequently expels Gary. So, I mean, that's how that all kind of comes about. And it's, again, it all really has its roots in the fact that Gary needed to take on partnership early in the foundation of TSR and D&D to make it happen. So it's amazing how these decisions you make, you know, when you need to early on to make something happen end up coming in, and in his case, biting him later down the road where that's how it all kind of resolved.
Absolutely. Thanks for that. And what was Gary's life like after all of this had blown over into his sort of golden years? It seems like he continued to be very active on online message boards and chat and very active in the convention community. But when you search Gary Gygax on YouTube, there's almost nothing of Gary speaking to an audience or anything like that, which surprised me. Can you talk to us about that period in Gary's life?
Well, absolutely. So after Gary was, you know, basically kicked out of TSR, you know, he sold out his shares. He moved on. He actually tried to start another gaming company called New Infinities and actually took some of his old TSR talent with him, some of the big hitters like Frank Mentzer and Kim Mohan. And they basically tried to put out, you know, based on Gary's name, they tried to put out some really innovative fantasy and other types of stuff, sci-fi stuff, too. But it doesn't take. It really doesn't work. There's not enough capital involved. TSR starts to get a little bit litigious and threatening with Gary because they see him as a competitor, which he is at this point. And so Gary ends up, New Infinity ends up folding relatively quickly. And Gary kind of starts, well, not freelancing is the wrong word. He gets interest from a lot of different places because he's kind of a legend in the space. But, you know, D&D, you know, by the late 80s, early 90s, again, there's the public interest of it had already waned. If you consider how big a deal it was circa 1982, 83, when it's got making appearances in ET, kind of the height of the satanic panic and all this, this stuff that's happening. So between, you might call it a waning interest in D&D relative to its high point, plus a lot of competition in the market, Gary becomes a little bit of a commodity. He ends up working with a Games Designer Workshop on another game called Dangerous Dimensions, which they have to change to Dangerous Journeys because TSR doesn't like the fact that it's a D&D. It's also a D&D game, then Dangerous Dimensions. So again, Gary kind of bounces around to these different game ideas, and he ends up writing some of them. He ends up publishing some of them. His last big game was this game called Legendary Ventures that he takes on in the late 90s. It goes through the early 2000s. He ends up getting another publisher for it. And it does okay. It's a very innovative game, an interesting game. But all this is to say, Gary hadn't struck a big hit for many, many, many years by say, 2000. And it was around that time where people that grew up with the game started to realize that this D&D thing was a pretty foundational, pretty amazing thing, and that Gary was behind it. And so he started getting credit in different ways, like, for example, his spot on Futurama, where, you know, he's there with Al Gore and Nichelle Nichols and Hawking, and kind of, you know, making these interesting appearances in pop culture where people are kind of suggesting that this guy really did lay the foundations of some important stuff. But, you know, again, he's not wealthy by this time. He hasn't really been able to cash in on the D&D craze that really funded his life so much earlier in his life. And it's kind of before the con movement really, really got hot. And I think that's probably most important to your question, is that the convention scene really, really started to explode in kind of the mid, let's call it circa 2005, a little bit later, perhaps. And Gary is kind of actually ill by that period and, you know, dies only just a couple years later in 2008. So I would say that where people really started to realize Gary and this incredible invention, Dungeons and Dragons with Dave Arneson, when it became this huge pop culture phenomena that people realized was foundational to so many big, multi-billion dollar phenomena that exist, was kind of a little bit too late for Gary to really enjoy too much of it. If that makes sense, you know, he didn't participate in message boards and various types of interviews. A lot of people did realize this. But, you know, if Gary was still living now, I mean, he would be a tremendous celebrity, an incredible celebrity. And he would have been for the last probably 5 years. He died just a little bit before, let's say, pop culture acknowledged his contribution.
Absolutely. In my interview with David Ewalt recently on his excellent book of Dice and Men, I talked about this anecdote of my friend who works with a marketing company in London, and they were trying to see what the popular kids in London are drinking at parties and how, you know, when they drink certain beverages and so on. So as part of this, he actually went to this party held by these painfully cool London kids that were just, you know, so fashionable, so hipster. And of all things that they were talking about during this wild night, their ongoing D&D campaign was one of them. So to me, that was just so striking in terms of how much D&D has changed in its place in popular culture.
No, I mean, it's pretty incredible. And I'm really glad that we've come to a place where there's a lot of things that are coming out that people are making the connections that things like, you know, Final Fantasy or World of Warcraft or what have you have their roots in this little tabletop game invented in 1974 by Gary Gygax. This really is the foundation of all of these huge multi-billion dollar pop culture phenomena. Even first-person shooter video games were directly inspired by D&D. That is to say that the people that invented that game were big players of it and actually found their concept from their ongoing campaign. You know, so there's all these little surprises about how the game has really moved mountains and has become this incredibly far-reaching movement, even though the game itself has always been somewhat contained. You know, even at its largest playership, you know, you're talking about maybe 3-5 million people. Today might be a little bit more. I think the game is doing as well today as it's done in perhaps ever. It's still a relatively esoteric diversion, that only certain people really want to partake in a live format. But it's become this tremendous kind of foundational piece of pop culture.
Absolutely. And I think that pop culture now is so much more microscopic in the sense of you can get podcasts on exclusively fifth edition or second edition or first edition Dungeons and Dragons, and people with those interests can easily find content on, you know, streaming on Twitch, on YouTube, on Facebook, in a way that they never could before, in a way that you would need to subscribe to very niche, you know, wargaming journals and talk to maybe 100 other people in North America. It definitely seems like it's really changed quite a bit just from my perspective as someone who, you know, I started the game in the early 90s.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think D&D is not only on the rise, but I think it's going to continue to get more and more visibility and kind of more and more interest as these big things that come out that are inspired by D&D, whether it be, you know, Stranger Things or whether it be Ready Player One or the forthcoming D&D film that Warner Brothers is working on or any number of things that really have a lot of their roots in D&D. Like, I think these things are going to get more and more pervasive and all that will end up coming back to the game and hopefully bringing more and more people back to the tabletop, which is a really special experience that, again, I would never want to get lost in all of this, that tabletop role-playing is a very special, very unique experience that's hard to recreate in any other format, whether it be MMOs or what have you.
Three more. Well, you've been very generous with your time. So wrapping up, as is the tradition, what's next for you, Michael?
Thanks for asking. I'm sad to say that I've got two projects that are both under wraps, so I can only say limited amount about both of them. But I can say a little bit, you know, the first of which is a book about Walt Disney and Disneyland that I'm very excited about, kind of the foundations of that and how it all went about. That's a pretty amazing story in many, many ways. So that's one of my projects. And the other is a book I can probably say even a little bit less about. I have a couple collaborators on it. And it's a book that I can tell you is very different than Empire of Imagination, but it is in, you would say, broadly in the role-playing history space, you might say.
Well, again, you've been so generous with your time, Michael. Empire of Imagination, just a fantastic book. Enjoyed the read so much, and we thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.